This is an ABC podcast.
When Prince Gooman was a kid, he was obsessed with Nike shoes.
10-year-old me would have the best birthday in the world if mom or dad got me a pair of Jordans or Nike Air Force Ones as a kid. And that was because of all this music and the culture that reinforces and talks about Jordans. You know, it's funny, nowadays, if you want a mention of a brand into a song, you have to pay a lot of money for it. But back in those days, you didn't. It was just part of culture and it showed up in verses. It totally inceptioned me to want these products.
Beneath the cool associations, though, which are no doubt effective, there's more going on in terms of how brands like Nike really target our brains. Decades of neuroscience and psychology research have given them greater insights into how we form our preferences and make our purchasing decisions.
Nobody says, oh, I bought, you know, Nikes because I want to project the self-image of, you know, XYZ. This all happens on a sort of implicit level. And by studying why we buy the things we buy and why we resonate with certain brands over others, we learn a lot about ourselves.
But is there a line we need to be wary of that, if crossed, lands companies in unethical territory? You're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, neuromarketing, the science and psychology of effective advertising, and when it all goes too far. In 2009, researchers in New York set up a pretty funny experiment. They wanted to know if people could identify the difference between duck pate and blended dog food.
The dog food was presented on a nice dish with some nice crackers and some garnishes, something that appeared visually as if you know, receiving it at a five-star Michelin restaurant. And then this was interspersed with actual pate from actual Michelin-star restaurants. And they had a group of naive participants try each one and guess which one is the dog food.
The diners couldn't really do it. They were no better at figuring out what was duck and what was dog food than if they were guessing at random.
So when you make the visual aesthetic look as if you're at a Michelin five-star restaurant, you really can't taste the difference between dog food and expensive pate. And so a really interesting example, I think, of really how our sense of taste, which is for humans our weakest sense, is very easily tricked by aesthetic and visual presentations.
This, by the way, is Dr. Matt Johnson.
I am a professor of consumer neuroscience, and I'm the author of Blindsight, Mostly Hidden Ways Marketing Reshapes Your Brain.
His co-author and business partner is Prince Gooman.
I'm a professor at Halt International Business School and the author of Blindsight.
Together, they also run Pop Neuro, a marketing education firm. Matt is the neuroscience expert, Prince the marketing one. And that dog food study, it's just one of many similar studies on how our perception of something can be easily influenced. Take wine, for example.
Neuroscientists love wine as a study. There's a series of them where you serve like an Opus One, really expensive wine in a red solo cup college style, and people report not enjoying it as much. And then you have a $2 bottle of Charles Schwab and you serve that in a Riedel glass and people enjoy it more. And then they keep changing the variable, right? Then you have a price written on the bottle and higher priced wine tastes better. And it goes back to the pate and the dog food example where, you know, perception really is reality sometimes. And it really informs what Matt and I labeled as mental models.
Mental model is a term from perceptual neuroscience, and it refers to how our brains interpret and process the world around us, creating our internal reality.
So we never actually experience the external world directly. We experience our brain's mental model of it. So you don't actually taste chocolate cake, you taste what your brain simulates of what that experience expects to be like.
Hang on. Before we go on, this is where I have to ask, what? When you say it's a simulation, do you mean like, I'm enjoying it because I expect to enjoy it? Like, I'm struggling a little bit to understand how is eating a cake a simulation? What do you mean?
Yeah, partly it is. So the mental model is informed by the actual sensory experience. There actually is a physical interaction happening at the level of the tongue, which is sending signal to your brain and informing that mental model. But imagine if, for example, you're eating the chocolate cake and halfway through, you're told, you know, that chocolate cake you're eating, the milk that was used to make that chocolate cake is actually human milk. And all of a sudden, that information changes fundamentally your mental model.
Right.
And that impacts pretty significantly how you'd experience that next bite of chocolate cake. So yeah, the actual cake itself, the ingredients, there is obviously, you know, input from our sensory systems, but so many other variables outside of that can actually influence directly this mental modeling process.
It's hilarious because you asked such a sharp question. Think about regular chocolate cake and red velvet.
Mm.
Exact same cake. You've got tasteless red food coloring in red velvet cake.
Wait. Red velvet cake is the same as chocolate cake?
Yes. Red velvet cake.
It's just red.
It's just red.
Oh my goodness.
And there you go. You have been had by your own mental model of a red velvet cake.
Wow.
Now, frosting, we're going to go ahead and clear out the frosting as a variable.
Right. Straight after our chat, I looked this up, and for baking purists, yes, there might be some slight differences in the ingredients used in chocolate versus red velvet cake, but both definitely have cocoa. Anyways, enough about cake, back to how mental models relate to marketing.
So this is a really interesting perspective which to understand marketing, because of course, these mental models are estimates, pretty good estimates sometimes. They're informed by the actual raw sensory experiences, but it's also informed by all sorts of things. So this gets back to the power of belief to sculpt mental models, expectation. So these mental models are fundamentally how we experience reality, but at the same time, they are very fallible. And they are very suggestible with a lot of the tools that marketers have at their disposal.
And you could say that brands are mental models themselves. At least that's how Prince puts it.
You know, brands use association design to create a mental model, right? So the classic example that won't go away is Coca-Cola, right? Coca-Cola equals happiness, and they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars globally to associate happiness with Coca-Cola, whether it's the polar bears or any of their commercials or any of their pop-ups or any of their experiential design stuff.
It's been an effective tactic for Coke, especially since it's a product that could hardly be described as necessary.
You look at Google as a product, Google search engine, and you think about the utility, it's 10 out of 10. With Coca-Cola, we're looking at zero, if anything, negative utility, right? 140 calories and 50 grams of sugar and all that stuff. So when you find yourself marketing a product that has minimal utility, you need to turn up the mental modeling. This is why you see Coca-Cola spend hundreds of millions of dollars every single year. And that is one example, right? You look at Nike and, you know, literally the god of victory, but also the gods of sport. That is the association they've created over and over and over again. And contrasting to Nike, there's Under Armour, which is not so much the gods of sport, but rather the underdogs of sport. And Under Armour has been able to do this messaging, but they are very specific in who they sponsor. So I'll give the example of Misty Copeland. They actually signed Misty as a spokesperson. And Misty's story is fascinating. She applied to the American School of Ballet when she was 15. And she wasn't just rejected. She was rejected brutally. And Under Armour did a commercial where they had Misty read the rejection letter. And it's heartbreaking. You know, you don't have the body type for American Ballet. With your body type, you're probably better off being a dancer in Vegas. Literally was in the rejection letter to a 15-year-old child.
Wow.
And Under Armour said, that's our underdog. Because Misty Copeland said, the hell with all that. She went ahead and she was, at that time, the first mixed race African American to be accepted into the American Ballet Academy. And Under Armour said, look, Nike's gonna go after the LeBron James and the Serena Williams of the world. This is our story. When you hear things like that, that is going to feed into your mental model of a Under Armour shoe versus a Nike shoe.
The surprising thing is, mental models can have real-world impacts.
This weird subjective mental modeling has shown that people hit a golf ball further if they believe that the golf club was made by Nike versus another brand if they like Nike. People jump a little higher if they believe in the Jordan brand or the Nike brand. So all these belief-based association design branding elements that feed into the mental models actually end up having real objective results that I would say are beneficial. So ultimately, you know, that's the thing. We have to walk that line, and we can obviously call out brands and or products that do shady stuff. While that's easy to do, I think what's not easy to do is actually appreciate the effect that a lot of this application of neuroscience and psychology to brand and product and some of the good that comes out of there.
That's really interesting, because my next question was going to be, is there reason to be concerned with these, you know, connections that are being made between these brands in our brain?
You know, I think, look, we're far removed from living in a world that is not going to be a consumerist society. So Matt and I always like saying this, is it's the answer to bad marketing isn't no marketing, it's better marketing, right? So for people who love Nikon or Canon, they get more joy out of photography because of the logo that is on the camera. And who are we to say that's evil? But for every example of that, when you throw in data and tech, then we're going down this rabbit hole of, oh my God, is this actually ethical, right? And that's a whole nother conversation.
We'll get to the ethics and tech conversation a little later. But first, a marketing tactic that has been deemed so unethical it's been banned is subliminal messaging.
So subliminal advertising, subliminal perception in general, is perceptual stimuli. They can be, you know, flashes of words, they can be images, but they're flashed too quickly for our conscious visual system to actually detect them. But nonetheless, these stimuli can actually impact our emotions, our thoughts, and actually our later behavior.
Subliminal messaging got its start in the 50s in the United States, but it's not quite a cut and dry story. It begins with one man.
And this was a person by the name of James Vickery, who owned a movie theater. If you were to believe the story, at intermission back in those days, people rushed off to buy soda and popcorn because James Vickery apparently had stitched in buy soda and popcorn in milliseconds during the movie. So when it was halftime or intermission, people ran off and did it. Turns out that he didn't actually do that. He created that story to create hype. So maybe he was more of a salesperson than a neuromarketer, but that is the first example of subliminal, at least in theory, being attempted.
Subsequent studies have looked into the efficacy of subliminal messaging.
The good news there, from the standpoint of us consumers, is that number one, the effect sizes with these studies indicate that subliminal advertising has a pretty weak effect on us. So if we're already thirsty and we see a subliminal ad for Coke as opposed to Lipton iced tea, we're slightly more likely to, you know, go with the Lipton iced tea as opposed to Coke. But if we're, you know, sitting in a movie theater and there's a subliminal ad for Lipton iced tea, we're not just going to be a zombie and walk out of the movie theater and go to the concession stand and order a Lipton iced tea. So the good news is, number one, the effect sizes are relatively small. The other good thing is that subliminal advertising is banned in most countries. So you're not likely to be exposed to this type of input.
Why is it banned if it doesn't really work?
It's one of those things where it feels like it violates something, right? It feels like it's violating my autonomy blatantly. And also, it's easy for public policy creators to go, yeah, that seems evil. That's it, you know. And luckily, like Matt said, luckily it has minimal impact.
The bad news, though, I think, is that there's still something called midliminal advertising. And these are the types of advertising stimuli which can still have an effect on us subconsciously, but are simply hiding in plain sight.
Midliminal advertising. It's a term Matt and Prince coined to describe what seems to be a pretty common marketing practice.
Subliminal stuff happens so fast, it's below your conscious awareness. But midliminal are things that are hiding in plain sight. I'll give you one industry example, and I'm hoping the next time you drive past a billboard or see an ad in a magazine or TV commercial for a watch, you'll think of this. Every watch ad has the time 10:10. And you might initially think, well, okay, so if I want to show off the brand Rolex and the model Submariner, whatever it is, there's many different ways to place the hand so that we can see the brand. Why is it always 1010? Well, liminally speaking, 1010 resembles a smile and you have more of a positive nudge. Now, is that going to make you go buy a $5, $10, $15, $20,000 Rolex? Of course not. But if you're in the market for that, it's at least going to have a more positive impact. That's industry-wide. So we go into pop culture, 30 Rock or any old Spielberg movie, Back to the Future. Go back and watch Back to the Future and see how many references to Pepsi there are in there, right? Michael J. Fox is always around a Pepsi machine for some reason. That's midliminal. It's sitting right there. The entire product placement industry is a midliminal industry.
Right. And I guess that's why Air Jordans worked for you as a kid.
That's clearly, right? This is why Air Jordans work for me. I have one pair as an adult and I almost never wear it, but it's sitting there. I'm living my childhood dream.
You're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, how advertisers target our brains, influence our decisions, and empty our wallets. Prince Gooman is a marketer and Matt Johnson is a neuroscientist. And together they wrote Blindsight, the mostly hidden ways marketing reshapes our brains. And one thing our brains love is pleasure.
Pleasure is a really fascinating psychological phenomena to try and understand, because pleasure is fundamentally a motivating emotion. Humans aren't designed from an evolutionary standpoint to just bask in pleasure. So if we just were actually content with what we had, we wouldn't be motivated to get the next, you know, 50, 100, 200 calories. So essentially what the brain does is it tends to place all of the pleasure and all of the motivating emotion in the anticipation of the actual goal. So you actually experience much more pleasure right before you attain whatever it is that you're anticipating. So going back to the chocolate cake example, so you think it's going to be amazing and delicious, and you actually experience the majority of the pleasure in the actual anticipation of eating it. And then once you attain this, we experience what's called diminishing returns. So every bite after the first is a little bit less enjoyable, a little bit less enjoyable. So pleasure tends to be really an emotion which motivates us, is not an emotion that we can experience for very long.
And what our brains like best of all isn't the anticipatory pleasure, though that's still definitely great. What we like best is unexpected pleasure.
Pleasure is at its highest when it's unexpected. This is why, you know, you think about the classic Oprah Winfrey example. You get a car, you get a car, you get a car. But you actually look at how the narrative played out on TV. It was one unexpected event after another that tied into a larger event.
That famous Oprah segment from 2004 started with 11 unsuspecting audience members, all teachers who needed a car, getting called on stage. I'd play the audio from the show if I could, but copyright rules mean I can't. So let me recap how it unfolded. Only once all 11 teachers are assembled on stage are they told they're receiving cars. Next, Oprah tells the audience there is one more car to give away, and that everyone is about to receive a box, but only one box contains a key. Whoever gets the key gets the final car. The audience is told to wait to open their box until everyone has received theirs. And then, finally, they're given the green light. Of course, each person opens their box and they think,
oh my God, I have a car key. I just want a free car.
But then,
the person next to them has a key and the person two rows above has a key. And then all of a sudden, you come to the realization that everyone gets a car. And that was just unexpected pleasure in layers and layers and layers, all happening live and recorded. It's just a great example of unpredictability and pleasure.
So why do our brains like unexpected pleasure in particular?
So coming back to the neuroscience of pleasure, what this means is that when we expect something to be amazing, and it is amazing, it's still okay. But if we expect something to be just so-so and it exceeds our expectation, then actually our pleasure response is increased. So there's a lot of research really suggesting this is the case, and it's really suggesting as well that the rewards that we can't anticipate are not only enjoyed the most, but also shape our behavior to a far greater extent as well.
What are the dangers in all of this for consumers and their relationships with brands and buying? Or is there any danger in any of this?
Yeah, so I think absolutely. We have some very sort of naive ideas, all of us. You know, humans have very naive ideas about what's actually going to make us happy. And this, again, comes back to anticipatory pleasure. We feel that, you know, once I finally get that new car, then I'll be happy. Once I finally get, you know, my 1,000th subscriber, then I'll be happy. But again, we come back to our sort of general baseline of happiness, and then we go about sort of chasing the next thing and the next thing. And the consumer world really conforms to this tendency. This is why, for example, iPhone releases a new model every single year with pretty minimal changes to the model. People line up for it because, you know, it's the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. There's actually some interesting research showing that every time a new iPhone model is announced, people, I'm using scare quotes here, accidentally drop and break their phone because they are, you know, they want the excuse to get a new phone because then I'll finally be happy. So it comes back to how the consumer world conforms to that general tendency.
I want to talk about the hedonic treadmill a bit. So we're biologically programmed to live life on a hedonic treadmill, right? It's called the pursuit of happiness for a reason. It's not called the achievement of happiness because the pleasure we get from getting something is at its absolute peak at the moment just before you acquire it. And after that, like Matt said, it goes back down to the baseline. You can see this in the iPhone example. You can see this in, you know, the best-selling video game in the world is FIFA. FIFA 2020, FIFA 2021, FIFA 2022. When we're on the hedonic treadmill, you can create product release life cycles that sort of optimize for that, right? I don't know if I would use the word dangerous to describe that. But now let's go back to unpredictability, right? Think about that unpredictability applied to social media, right? When you're scrolling, you literally have no idea what will show up at the bottom of your feed because that's the type of stuff that keeps us engaged because biologically it's a lack of prediction of what will come next that keeps us thumbing and thumbing. Again, there's many things happening psychologically in the back end of that, but it's also how you actually design for unpredictability on these apps.
Yeah, where and when does all of this cross over into unethical territory, not just in terms of pleasure, but like the other sort of techniques you've talked about?
Ooh, that's a good point. I think that tech, or let's just say free social media platforms, are a reflection of our own consumer behavior. I'm not blaming the consumers for it, but they are a reflection of our own consumer behavior, meaning that for whatever reason, no matter how great this content is, Sana, you're going to produce this show and it's going to be free and it takes so much work on your part to do all this stuff. But ultimately, content wants to be free. So when you put that free mentality onto a corporation who has to make money, they have triangulated on a different way of making money, which is instead of monetizing the user by charging them once a month, they're monetizing the user's attention. And then you look at, you know, billions of people on Facebook. That is the largest piece of research you can do, right? The scale is huge. And it is all driven by an incentive to keep people staring at the screens. It's easy to say that that's unethical, but until you, me, and Matt are willing to pay $4 or $5 a month for WhatsApp and Instagram, until we're actually able to do that, these companies are not nonprofits, right? They're going to monetize some way, shape, or form.
But part of the problem, according to Matt, is that consumers aren't fully aware of how they're being used.
You can think of marketing as an exchange of value. So in an idealized exchange, the consumer can touch the product, they can feel the product, they can interrogate its structural integrity, and if they feel that it's going to be valuable to them in their life, they can part with whatever amount of money that the company is charging it for. And then that's a good, healthy, ethical exchange, a sort of normative model of marketing ethics. So in the case of technology, you still have an exchange of value. The companies are still monetizing and consumers are still glued into these apps, but this becomes an unethical exchange of value because consumers aren't aware of how this value is being exchanged. The monetary exchange that I described is just one of many different ways which a company can profit off an individual. The value can also be extracted in terms of data. Value can also be extracted in terms of attention, which can then be monetized and sold to advertisers. And consumers aren't sufficiently aware of all the value that's being extracted from them. So I think sort of fundamentally, we're trying to create a model for normative ethics, and we're trying to think about the different ways in which technology companies specifically tend to violate that. This is one of the sort of prime candidates of where these ethical issues exist.
And I guess the issue with tech is, you know, there are such bigger, broader implications to how we interact with tech. You know, I'm talking about in terms of radicalization with, you know, YouTube keeping us glued to ever more videos and then Facebook scrolling and all the rest. Like, we've seen the political implications of how tech companies are using some of these marketing techniques to keep us hooked. It's not just a relationship between you and Nike and some friends that like Nike anymore.
Absolutely. That's one of the most shocking consumer behavior trends during the pandemic is what we were seeing before the pandemic is there was all this news and all this bad PR that big tech companies like Facebook were getting, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. And we saw time on site actually go down for a lot of these companies for the first time in a long time. And we were moving towards sort of more mindfulness when it comes to technology use. And then, of course, we head into the pandemic and everyone is all of a sudden can't go outside and locked out and you're glued to your phones all over again. And so the interesting, I think, shocking thing there is that if you poll the average person, you say, well, what's your opinion on Facebook? They say, oh, it's a terrible company. They should be disbanded. Hate Mark Zuckerberg, hate all these things. But you look on their phone and, you know, they're going on Facebook 2 hours a day. They, you know, are using WhatsApp. They're using Instagram. So there's this divide between public sentiment about these companies and how much they continue using them. And this really speaks to the power of these tactics, getting people to stay on longer and longer and longer, much longer than they ordinarily would. So I think people were concerned for all the reasons that you've mentioned, and still people aren't willing to part with these apps.
All of this comes back to why Prince and Matt wrote their book.
For me, as a neuroscientist, I really hope that people understand themselves better as consumers, really understand how marketing interacts with essentially every aspect of our psychological lives.
I hope understanding your psychology through the lens of your buying behavior helps you understand yourself better. That's one hope. The second hope is what I mentioned earlier. It's not so much vilifying, but understanding that marketing is a trade of value and perhaps appreciating it when it's done ethically. It does charm. It does connect. So to me, if you read Blindsight and you actually go, man, this is why I like pop-up restaurants. It's not to vilify why pop-ups work, why surprises work. It's to actually appreciate, because we live in a world now where our options to satisfy a need far outstrip the number of needs themselves, right? So just to buy a tennis shoe, good luck, right? Because you need shoes, but you've got, you know, hundreds of different companies doing it. So the fact that you picked an Allbirds for whatever reason and understand the neuroscience behind that hopefully leads to a greater appreciation. Really, can we be consumer connoisseurs? Can we go, ooh, okay, I like this. I see what you're doing, Adidas, and I appreciate it, and take my money.
That's marketing expert Prince Gooman, and before him, neuroscientist Dr. Matt Johnson. They're the authors of the book Blindsight: The Mostly Hidden Ways Marketing Reshapes Our Brains. That's it for All in the Mind this week. Our producer is James Bullen. Sound engineer is Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Sana Kadar. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.